Thank you, Doug, for that lovely introduction and for giving my talk. But that was not my Q&A. And Craven, thank you. And thank all of you for coming out this evening. I really appreciate it. It is meant to be an informal evening together. I do have several important messages. And then I'll get into the thrust of my talk. The first, by the way, is I want to reassure all of you that there is still a medical school affiliated with Roy Williams basketball program. And it is not true that promotion to tenure requires 2 out of 3 hitting net only from the NBA arc. That's not true. It's the NC2A arc. I need to come up with some sort of statement about who I am and why I'm writing books like this. In the course of the next 45 minutes, I'm going to trash the institution of medicine in our country. That's not UNC. That's the institution of medicine in our country. I wish I could tell you that UNC Academic Health Center is better than most. I can't tell you that. I can tell you it's not worse than most either. But I'm not going to talk about UNC's Academic Health Center. I'm going to talk about the establishment, institution, and enterprise of American medicine. And I'm not going to be gentle. The next thing I have to make sure you understand is that I don't bash doctors. Medicine's a ministry for me. I've been working in hospitals since I was 11 years old. There is nothing more important than and more privileged than the care of a patient, of a fellow human being who turns to one out of trust. I've been a medical educator for 35 years. There's nothing about that that I consider trivial. I consider the absolute focus of everything I've done. And the biggest resource we have in our country is this enormous core of very bright men and women who would love to practice according to their conscience if they didn't live in a country that has formulated an institution of medicine that makes it very hard to practice according to their conscience. So I'm not bashing doctors. To the contrary, I actually think it's a good idea that if we had doctors who were capable of going to the bedside with no other rule than the care of the patient, we'd all be better off. Now, with that as an introduction to where I come from, my lesson for the evening is very simple. I want all of you to go through the rest of your life when you're faced with informed medical decision-making and mumble effectiveness. That's all. That's what I'm trying to do tonight. I want you to be able to ask in a substantive way, how certain are you that this or that will really advantage me? Because if it's done efficiently, and if it's done well, and it doesn't advantage me, I don't want it. I don't even care if it's cheap. So that's all I'm trying to teach you. And teaching that lesson is not easy in our country. It's easier in almost every other country in the resource-advantaged world than it is in ours. It's not easy because the lesson will seem counterintuitive. Now we're going to talk about 4 constructs. All will seem a bit counterintuitive. Let's see if I have a pointer here. We're going to end up talking about the notion of the social construction of health. Disease objectifies itself. I can give lectures forever about disease, but health is socially constructed. What does it mean to be well? We're going to talk about these 2 topics in the middle. Medicalization is taking life events, life features, life aspects, and deciding they're diseased. And in doing that, wondering if you're better off for that exercise. And by the way, medicalization and type 2 malpractice are the scourges of our institution of medicine and of our country and of its healthcare delivery system. Type 1 medical malpractice, you all know. It's doing something to you that was necessary, but doing it poorly. Type 2 medical malpractice is doing the unnecessary, even if you do it well. There's a colleague of mine who keeps yelling at me that I ought to talk about type 3 medical malpractice, which is doing the unnecessary poorly. But right now, I'll settle for type 2. And I want to start off having us all rethink these big words at the top here, the difference between proximate cause and life course epidemiology. Proximate cause epidemiology is what you hear about all the time. It's the study of what kills you. It's the study of what ends up on your death certificate. And most of medical education focuses on proximate cause epidemiology. And that's always bothered me. When starting as a first-year medical student in Edwardian times, I kept this little book of aphorisms. I used to call them Hadley's Laws of Therapeutic Dynamics. I've actually published the first four laws. And the first law occurred to me as a first-year student. Hadley's first law is the death rate is one per person. Now, once you say that, then I don't really care so much about what kills me. I care when. Care when. And if I care when, I'm talking about life course epidemiology. And as rich as the science is on proximate cause epidemiology, and as well covered as it is by the press and the print and broadcast media, and you all know about all these horrible things that can happen to you, the science of life course epidemiology, which is also called social epidemiology, the number of terms for it, is equally rich. And you don't know about it because there's nothing to sell except when. Now when do I consider myself to have arrived at a ripe old age? In the mid-80s, two very important papers, absolutely crucial papers, came out in the New England Journal that helped me understand the when. One was published by a group in Stanford, and it was terrific, and the other we published, and it was better. The we was, I was working with a young man who was a Moorhead both back then and as an undergrad and as a medical student. He's now the professor of geriatrics at the University of Virginia, Mark Williams. And we were dealing with the when. What does it mean to have a ripe old age? What the Stanford group predicted was what has come to pass. What you're looking at is the likelihood of surviving as a function of age through the 20th century. These are the best we can get for this kind of data. It comes from the National Vital Statistics System, CDC, National Center for Health Statistics. It was published last summer. It takes a while for these kinds of data to mature. Now, the usual American asked about life expectancy would say something like Ponce de Leon, that you would predict through the 20th century that the first thing that would happen is infant mortality would go away. And then there would be a series of monotonic curves, straight lines, and more people would be living longer and longer through the 20th century. And that's not what's happening. What's happening is the longevity curves are getting rectilinear, so rectilinear that you can almost predict the idealized curve for our species. When I think about this, in fact, when I teach about this, it depends on the weather and my mood. Sometimes I think about lemmings. But usually I think something like this. If you're fortunate to be born in the resource-advantaged world, everything I'm saying is over the epidemiologic watershed, which means it's safe to drink the water. If you're talking about Java, Java looks like this. Hasn't budged off of 1900. If you're fortunate enough to be born in a world like ours, then you are born with a warranty. And at age 85, you're off warranty. And a few of you will make it longer than that. And of those who make it longer than that, not all will be happy for it. Now that's a very important notion, that a ripe old age is someplace around my 85th birthday. On my 85th birthday, I don't care how many diseases I have. I don't even care which one kills me. I just care that it was my 85th birthday and I can look back and smile. That's a very interesting, different notion of health than we teach this country. The implications are enormous. For example, you can't die in America You can't die in America without a diagnosis. I've tried it many times. It's kind of fun. I signed out death certificates. It was her time. Raleigh bounces it. Actually, they bounce it angry. He said, Dr. Hatton, you know better. I said, yes, I know better. That's why I said it. What do you want me to do here? He said, put down the diet. And so when you hear about the epidemic of heart disease, ask when. When? When you hear about the epidemic of whatever the epidemic, the scare of the week happens to be, ask when. Because much more important is the notion of when than what, once you're at your 85th birthday. Now, in our society, there's a large segment of these straight lines and non-straight lines. They have population coordinates. There are populations that are living this average expectancy. There is a great segment of our American society, greater, by the way, than any other resource-advantaged country. And every other resource-advantaged country is closer to the idealized species rectilinear curve than we are. There is a big population that lives on a 1950 curve. Now, if I asked you, how do you identify them? You would give me the usual American Heart Association litany of risk, gut-butt ratio, hypertension, health adverse behaviors, maybe disparities in access to health care, this litany. And you're not wrong, but you're not very right. About 20% of your mortal hazard, of your likelihood of not making it to 85, lives in that litany. 80% is captured with two other questions. Two other questions. Now, the way I'm going to show them to you is push the second statistics. Clinton Nero wouldn't have had this slide because we have lots of trouble with these words, black and white, at the scientific level. We have lots of trouble ascribing health outcomes to an ancestral continent of origin. With the exception of infant mortality, the question about socioeconomic status will subsume all of it. And I'm going to show you more of that later. So the first question is, are you comfortable in your socioeconomic status? If you tell me that you're not comfortable in your socioeconomic status, it will cost you 5 to 7 years on this earth. It will cost you much more than your gut-butt ratio ever will. Now, listen to what I said. I didn't ask, are you rich? I asked, are you comfortable in your socioeconomic status? Because it doesn't correlate directly with money the way you might think. For example, the poor in North Carolina have more purchasing power than the poor in Greece. The poor in Greece live longer and it has nothing to do with olive oil. You can do this country to country with a measure called the income gap. If you look at the distance between the income of the top quintile and the income of the bottom quintile, in any closed microcosm, the bigger the distance, the sooner the poor die. You can do it in Los Angeles. You can do it state by state. You can do it state, can you read any of those? This one, the bigger the income gap, the sooner the poor die. That's South Carolina. The northern Midwest looks like the Canadian provinces. That's why it's called the Robin Hood effect. It's not that they're poor states, Minnesota. It's just that the income gap is closer. It's as if the rich are distributing to the poor in a way that the community, so nothing to do with anything but this notion of the world in which you live and how comfortable are you in it. There's, you've all heard about the Framingham study. Everybody knows the Framingham. It's sort of the 11th commandment, thou shalt know your cardiovascular risk factors. And the Framingham's not the only study. There are many like that. One came out of our School of Public Health. The principal investigator was Al Tyrola, a wonderful, wonderful man, an epidemiologist, cardiologist by training, who died at a ripe old age a couple of years ago. And he had a cohort study like Framingham, but Framingham is just Framingham, and it's pretty homogeneous. He actually had thousands of people enrolled all over the country. And he found what they found in Framingham, that there's a little risk if your cholesterol's up, a little less risk if your HDL's up with your up cholesterol, the usual thing. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. And so a little bird said to Al, you know, Al, why don't you see, since you've got such a heterogeneous population, what happens if you factor in socioeconomic status? You know what happens? Couldn't even discern the lipid risks. And then the little bird said to Al, what happens, he's following these people for decades, what happens if you're born in the low quintile and you work your way up? What happens to your longevity? Well, you do better, but you never catch up. Barker's group in Birmingham, England has it in utero. We have no idea what the biology is here. We have dozens of theories, many of which are untestable, which means they're fatuous. But it's that powerful. It is one of two extremely powerful questions to ask if you want to make it to a ripe old age. While we're talking about cholesterol, let's talk about risk factors and screening. Now let me give you a rule about screening. You never, ever, ever, ever want to be screened unless the test is accurate, the disease is important, and we can do something about it. That's really not hard to grasp. That really isn't. Well, if you ask those three questions of most of our national screening programs, you're in for a rude awakening. Let me show you an example of this. Washington Post did a big piece on me a few years back as the doctor wouldn't let you check his cholesterol. I have no idea what my cholesterol is. I know that's un-American, but I could care less. It actually is an accurate test. Now, it wasn't. And it's speaking to an important disease. But can you do anything about it? Well, of course you can. You take a statin, you lower the cholesterol. Is that a meaningful thing to me? I actually don't know what my cholesterol is. I mean, if it's up a little bit, I don't itch. If it's down a little bit, I don't stop it. I mean, you don't know what your cholesterol is. You don't feel it. It's not. We are treating a surrogate marker of a process. And we can lower your cholesterol. But that's not what your question was. Remember what I want you to mumble. Will it lead to anything meaningful for me? So let me show you the best study. The best study of lowering the high cholesterol in otherwise well men who are defined as having a high cholesterol the way everybody is defined as having a high cholesterol. By committee. I will tell you in the population at large, not these very special families where people drop dead in their 20s, but in the population at large, there are some people with extraordinarily high LDL cholesterols. Those people have a mortal hazard of about 2%. That means there's about 3 years of their life at risk. For almost all of you who think you have a high cholesterol, there are months of risk if you think you can even measure that. And then there's the next question, does dropping the cholesterol do something for my risk that I care about? So this is the famous West of Scotland study. 6,000 Scottish men randomized for a 5-year study of taking placebo or taking Pravacol, one of the statins, and taking it drops their cholesterol. And at the end of 5 years, they looked at what happened, and death by heart attack, there was no life saved. Not a single life was saved. That's interesting. So anybody who's put you, this is called primary prevention, on a statin to save your life, you've got to say, huh? There is a difference in the incidence of non-fatal heart attacks. 2% absolute difference. That is marketed as a 30% reduction. Anytime anybody tells you relative risk reduction, laugh at it. Relative risk reduction is totally meaningless unless you know the absolute numbers. If it went from not 6%, but if it went from 65% to 45%, I might care a little bit. Even I'd pop a pill. But for 2% is on the cusp of where I might believe it. 2% means I have to treat 50 men, have to take a statin every morning for 5 years, and maybe 1 out of 50 will be spared a non-fatal heart attack. Do you believe that that will reproduce? Let me tell you why it might not reproduce. And there are lots of reasons why it might not reproduce, but let me tell you the most benign of them. Some of the malignant ones are every time we have a group of studies on the same drug done by industry and compare it to a group of studies on the same drug by government, somehow it's far more likely to be a positive study when it's industry supported. And I can go on and on about that. Let me tell you the limitation that relates to biological principles. Here's 6,000 middle-aged men. I used to define that as 5 years older than I am. These are men with a mean age close to 60. They all had high cholesterol. I can tell you that every one of them had coronary artery disease, even though every one of them had no such history. So they were well men. But the last time coronary arteries were pristine was when they were in their 20s. So they all have coronary artery disease. And some of them have a tremendous amount of it, and they're well. And some of them have very little. And when you do a randomized controlled trial, the principle is that something like the amount of coronary artery disease will distribute 50-50. Now, we could find out by doing coronary arteriograms on all 6,000 men, but no, even industry-based institutional review boards would have ethical problems with that. Coronary arteriograms are not trivial, and you bump off a few people and make a bunch sick. There's no way you would do that. So we can't find out. We have to assume that the worst involved subclinical asymptomatic men distribute 50-50, and the best distribute 50-50. How about if they go 51-49, 49-51? Improbable. It's called randomization error. We get burnt by it all the time. You have to assume that it's lurking. It's one of the many things like this that you assume is lurking. So at some point you say it's too small an effect for me to put my informed medical decision thinking behind. Actually, 2% is the arguable cusp of too small an effect, an NNT of 50. 50 people have to be treated in order to do something good for one. I actually don't believe that. I'm tougher. I like NNTs of 20. 20 people have to be treated to do something terrific to one before I'll believe it. But someplace between 20 and 50 is a philosophical debate. Most of the science that we're hearing about doesn't come close to 50. That's why this year, if you give your kids margarine, you're a criminal. And last year, if you gave them butter, you were a criminal. There's no way you can measure these kinds of itty-bitty effects. And you couldn't measure them in 10,000 inbred mice. And we base an awful lot of science on 10,000 outbred Italians. So small effects, I don't like. Let me get you right in the face. By the way, it's my introduction. How long do we go? with the lottery issue. The lottery issue. I'm going to walk you out of here with the lottery issue flat in the middle of your thinking. The lottery issue goes something like this. hey, it could happen, you know? So it's one in a thousand. One in a thousand that gets this effect. And I don't even have to pay for it. It comes out of insurance, so you're paying for my lottery ticket. I'll go for it. I'm going to go for it. It's the American notion that someone's going to win. But this is not a lottery. This is a RCT, a randomized controlled trial. What the one in a thousand is all about is the people, one in a thousand on placebo is likely to do that well too. It's like winning the lottery without buying the ticket. So it's not the lottery notion. When you hear that there's no significant or no important or no meaningful difference between placebo effects and drug effects, that means you're about as likely to do as well not getting the thing done to you as you would if you get lay down and get it done to you. I have cardiovascular surgeons and interventional cardiologist in Dante's Second Circle, which is already populated by the spine surgeons, which is the topic of my next book, which is called Stabbed in the Back, that UNC Press will release in September. And it's not their fault. It's not their fault. It's what I call the folly of peer review. And I think it pertains to Wall Street, too. I mean, I don't think Wall Street's populated by miscreants and misanthropes. It's populated by people. And they sit around and they say, my bundle's bigger than your bundle, and I get this big bonus, and I'm terrific. Well, these people sit around and say, my stent's bigger than your stent, and they're much more interested in whether they got the stent in. And they very seldom step back and say, should I have done it? Now, Hadley's second law is there's never been a quack without a theory. And the theory underlying all this is the occluding plaque is the enemy. And that theory's been around a long time, and it was first broached in the 70s with the bypass graft. Gee whiz, this is a plumbing issue, and now we can put sick people to sleep and do horrible things to their heart, and most of them wake up. Not all of them. And half of them wake up and they're depressed for at least 6 months, and about 30% of them have lost memory, easily to measure in 1 year, but they woke up. And then there was a lot of hue and cry about this. Are they better off? And the reason there was hue and cry is in the early days of bypass grafts, there was a randomized sham controlled trial. Oh, everybody looks at me, what are you talking about? That's right, sick men with angina were all put to sleep. And all of them had their skin cut. And half of them had their chest cracked and had an early version of a bypass graft. And they woke up. And the people, half of the people who had the bypass graft said, my angina is gone. Know what percentage of the people who had the sham procedure said their angina's gone? Half. It's not because there's nothing wrong with their hearts. It's because of anticipation of pain. It's because of a whole bunch of things that deal with the world of pain. So there were debates on bypass grafting from the get-go, and because of the debates, there were three enormous randomized controlled trials comparing bypass grafts with medical therapy, carried out, one of them went 11 years. One was in the Veterans Administration, one was multi-center in this country, the other was multi-center in Europe. With the exception of a tiny percentage of all comers, 3% of all comers with a particular kind of heart disease, no lives were saved. No lives were saved. But the theory had to be right. So why were no lives saved? Well, it's because the bypasses clot up again. So ever since that time, the bypass grafters have been trying to figure out ways to keep their grafts open, assuming that if they could, that these people would make it to a ripe old age. And without that, they wouldn't. Now, Let me point out another fact of life. Another fact of life. My chance of having a heart attack at my age is about 35% less than my father's chance of having a heart attack when he was my age. And we don't know why that is. Medicine loves to take credit for it, but that's a lot of crap. Furthermore, if my father had a heart attack at my age, his 5-year survival was 50%. If I have a heart attack tonight, otherwise well, man, a little crazy, but otherwise well, no prior history of anything, you know what my 5-year survival is? 96%. And I can raise it to 98% with a dramatic intervention of a baby aspirin, which is either a 2% increase in survival or a 50% decrease in mortality, depending on whether I want you to take the aspirin. So one of the problems cardiology has is that their target is moving. Heart disease is nowhere near the scourge it was in mid-century and into the 60s and 70s. But the theory held. And along came a Swiss cardiologist who said, why are you bypassing it? Why don't we just go in there with a balloon and bust the thing up? It's called angioplasty. So they started doing that. And it didn't seem to improve over the bypass grafts because there were multiple trials comparing bypass with angioplasty. And of course, the angioplasty also clots. So another genius said, well, why don't you put a little piece of tubing in there? Keep it open. Our bodies don't like pieces of tubing in blood vessels. And they clot. And they did all kinds of, one of the nation's leading experts in clotting here is about to throw something at me. It's a nice thing about former residents. They very quickly are brighter than you are. So there are a number of them here I can see are about to kill me. So they said, well, why don't we put something, coat these things, and see if we can keep them from clotting. And thousands of trials of widget against bypass, widget against widget, coated against plain, plain against different coating have been published. And it's the only real difference they've come up with is the coated stents stay open longer and kill more people 6 months down the pike. And then, after all this time, because of people with big mouths like me, it's a nice thing about peer review and it's what you need in professions, we have trials looking at stenting versus best medical therapy. Best medical therapy. This one is 2006, it's called the O trial. A couple of thousand patients, all of whom had heart attacks, all of whom had occlusion of the blood vessel that persisted following the heart attack. Half of them had angioplasty, mostly with stents. The other half had best medical therapy, which means a pill or two. And you want to know, at 4 years, about 17% of those who had angioplasty were sick, and only 15% who had the medical therapy were sick. And then came this, I love cardiologists, they must have committees, like drug companies have committees to figure out how to call a drug something with a Z. The cardiologists are like the Pentagon, they need acronyms. This is called the COURAGE trial. This is the next one, this year and a half ago. Another 2,000 patients with active angina, another one of the major indications for angioplasty and stenting, were randomized, and at 5 years, the rates of death of myocardial infarction were almost 20% in the angioplasty stent group and less in the medical therapy group. And at the end of 5 years, they thought there was a lower rate of angina in the angioplasty group, but that disappeared by year six. So we are still doing 1.5 million bypass grafts, angioplasties, and stents in the United States of America each year. Now why? Why do we do that? How do we get away? Well, it's the folly of peer review. By the way, these two trials went before FDA advisory committees, all of which had been published. There was this wonderful trying to behave with my language discussion, and great inventive language on the part of the interventional cardiology community, which was, we don't do it that way. And they did things that we don't do, and we do it better. Well, if anybody offered me this great marvel of modern technological wizardry, I'm out of Dodge. No two ways, even if I die, I'm out of Dodge. I'd rather die without a cracked chest, because I'm not going to be any more likely to live with one. That's called type 2 medical malpractice. What was that? I forget when we started. You doing all right? When I joined the Carolina faculty, a number of things were true. I was, number one, really bright. It's been downhill. Although I'm more fit. I like cycling. And I was a very good physical chemist. And then my first patient said to me, "Doc, I have a backache and I don't know if I can go to work." And that really did a number on me. And I've spent 35 years studying what I call the illness of work incapacity. And I know a tremendous amount about it. That's why the next book is called Stab in the Back. It's coming out in October. I'm not going to take you through as much as we could on this topic. I am going to use low back pain, what I call regional back pain. This cartoon, it was done when I gave the American College of Physicians lecture on this topic, and in the audience was the father of one of my interns who turned out that he wasn't listening to me, but he was a great cartoonist. And that's me with before the hair grayed. And it's the question that I essentially would ask you, but I'm going to give you the answer. If any one of you goes 1 year without a backache, that's truly, truly abnormal. Sorry. That's the first thing I've got to tell you. And the reason we know that is from a tremendous amount of community-based epidemiology. We actually go, sometimes it's done with diaries. We ask people to keep a diary every night for the next 6 weeks before you go to bed. Write down every miserable thing that happened to you and what you did about it. So we have these kind, or do you remember? Most of you don't remember the last backache. Most of you don't remember the last backache. There's a paper done by a friend of mine who's a most extraordinary man, and despite the fact he's a spine surgeon, but he's a non-operating spine surgeon. He's also a professor at Stanford and a general in the medical corps who spends half the year in Iraq. We almost lost him last year. And he's been keeping records on what are called resilient soldiers. Soldiers who never consent. When you ask them, do you have a backache? This is special forces. The answer is no. And then they look at frequent questionnaires. And what's remarkable about this kind of person is, of course, they had backaches. But there's no way they can remember them. It just isn't part of their persona. Next thing I need to tell you before I explain where we're going with this is this slide. This comes from Heidelberg in 1928. We now do this with MRIs instead of autopsies. The last time you had a normal anatomy of your spine was age 14. And in this room, there's a lot of abnormal spinal anatomy. Just a lot of it. There really is. Tough. Now, if I ask you to think through what that means, most of you would say, well, this is mental fatigue. This is the way I've lived, what I've done. This is wear and tear arthritis. All of those notions are today, forevermore, expunged from your minds. That's been tested. Only about 2% of the variants for the pathology in your spine can be accounted for by things you did in life. 50% can be ascribed to mom or pop or both. Of all the genetic diseases that you're hearing about, probably where there are more than one gene, this and changes in the anatomy of your knee are the biggies. Most of what you're hearing about are trivial genetic components like heart disease, rheumatoid arthritis, absolutely trivial. Nothing's going to come of that. This is kind of neat. But the neat thing, too, is the amount of pathology correlates essentially not at all with whether you hurt. So if you have a regional backache, which means you're a working age adult and you're otherwise well, and there's been no violent event, and someone of my guild offers to image your back, you can ask that person, what's the chance that you can, with some degree of validity, find what's hurting today? Not find pathology, because you know that's there. Ascribe today's pain to some pathology you're about to show me. And if they give you an answer that's more impressive than 1 in 6,000, you can call them a liar. However, you'll all get imaged because you're Americans. Somebody's going to point to that thing, and two things will happen. You will assume that you have a bad back, and you will be vulnerable to the offer of a caring surgeon to put a incision someplace back there. Now, this slide captures 35 years of work. I can go on for weeks on this slide. This slide has fascinated me since I was just an assistant professor. Here's what I've told you. Sometime very soon you're going to have a backache, and the moment you have a backache, you have a predicament and you must do something about it. But we never talk in medical schools or in the major medical journals like Ladies' Home Journal and Time Magazine that you have choices. You have choices. We only talk about one choice, which is to tell me about your back pain. Now, the moment you tell me about your back pain, you're no longer a person, you're a patient, you no longer have a predicament, you have an illness, and I don't have words to capture the processing, the decision-making, except pejorative words. If you tell me you'd never tell me, I'll call you a denier. And if you tell me you'll always tell me, I'll call you a hypochondriac. But I don't have a word, no one has a word for just right. And you have two other options. You can deal with it. If you deal with it and remain a person, this is a very chauvinistic slide, it's not lonely. For 5,000 years, there have been all kinds of helpful people. They're willing to give you potions and pills and prod your back and gird your loins and yank on you and step on you and do all kinds of stuff, and it's all been studied. And essentially, you're buying a friend. And you better like the friend, and you better like your language that you learn from the friend, because all these modalities don't help. It's the treatment act, not the treatment. Or in the context of the workplace, if you make a complaint of your backache in the context, you are no longer a person, you're a claimant. And the kind of claimant you are depends on whether you use the language of injury. Remember, this is a regional backache. There's nothing new, different, and violent that happened. Or the language of illness. 40% of the North Carolina workforce has no health insurance, the only national health insurance scheme, which is a whole other lecture. Is this horror called workers' compensation. Now, why would you choose to be a claimant? And the usual response is, because it hurts so bad, and because I'm injured, and because there's something about the physical demands of work to which I am willing to ascribe this event. Now, that's the same reason you give me for coming to me as a patient. This is really bad. And I need to know what's causing it, and you, Doc, need to fix it. This is the next set of notions I need to expunge from you. We learned about this, by the way, first at Grandma's knees. When Grandma comes to the doctor with knee pain, in the ninth stage, she gets an MRI, she gets arthroscopy, for which we had a sham-controlled, randomized controlled trial, and that is a scam, it is a bogus procedure. And she limps out on some sort of non-steroidal. But if you go to her birth cohort and didn't go to the doctor, you discover a significant percentage of them have exactly the same x-rays, knee pain, and challenge in their daily living. And you know what separates the grandmother who went to the doctor from the grandmother who didn't? Loneliness. No way to treat loneliness with an arthroscope. I don't think there is any indication for arthroscopy. I would like to tell all the arthroscopists where they can put their arthroscope. Choosing to be a claimant. This is an important study. We've done lots like this. This is my favorite. We've talked about Al Tyrol's study, Framingham study. This is the Whitehall study. You've never heard of the Whitehall study. You should have heard of the Whitehall study. It ought to be front page. Michael Marmot's been studying British bureaucrats forever. He's been studying for the same reason that we had Framingham and Tecumseh. He showed early on that the higher you are in the civil service, the longer you live. And he spent years trying to figure out if they smoke more or less, if their gut-butt ratio is different. And the answer is, yeah, lower-level civil servants tend to have more cardiovascular risk factors, but very little more. Then 15 years ago, he asked, do you like your work? And if the answer is no, it will account for all of the differences in longevity. Furthermore, if you hate your work, and he tries to, we do too, try to parse out what do you mean by you hate your work. Sometimes it's easy. I work for a fascist, I have no choice. That'll do. That'll make your next back pain intolerable. And in our culture, that's your number one surrogate complaint. It's also true in choosing to be a patient. The chief complaint of anybody who goes to a doctor with a regional back pain is not my back hurts. It really is my back hurts and I can't cope with this episode. Here it's my back hurts and I can't cope with this episode too. And the number, the canary in the mine in our culture is back pain. But that's not why I put this up. Remember I said there were two questions I could ask you, and if you said yes to either one, it would cost you 7 years, and the first was, are you comfortable in your socioeconomic status? Second is, do you like your job? And it's exceedingly powerful. We unfortunately are doing enormous experiments and with lots of data. Next to fighting in Iraq and HIV/AIDS, the most impressive health adverse event that we've come across in our society in some time is the very evil notion of downsizing. Of downsizing not only is miserable, but it's lethal. The best data is not the Whitehall study, they have data. It is the 20-city study out of Finland. The Finnish economy tanked in 1991. By the way, we have this data in our country too. It's unfortunately easy data to get. It tanked and they got up to 18% unemployment, and there's a group of Finnish epidemiologists who are studying the employees of 20 cities, municipal employees, fair-sized cities. Not all of them had a downsize, some did, some didn't. If you were in a city that had a downsize compared to the cities that didn't, and you were booted, you had a fivefold increase in cardiovascular events and death in the next 5 years. And if you stayed behind, you weren't booted, but you were left behind, twofold. Something about the way I usually think about this and teach it, it's very hard to capture this in language. The industrial psychologists talk about words like flow. I talk about comfortable in your skin. Now, we're not all comfortable in our skin all the time. But it ought to kind of settle in. And it's the biggest of our health issues. Which takes me full circle to what our major issues are for health in a society like ours, which has to do with being disallowed and disaffected and disavowed, and takes us back to this notion of the social construction of health. What you look at actually was 2 years ago when I used this slide last. I was asked to keynote the inaugural meeting of the Swiss Academy of Health Insurance in Basel. And I stood up before this very large room and I said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you you have the second most irrational healthcare delivery system in the universe and you'll never, ever catch us. We have an enormous amount invested in things that we can have science that says we cannot demonstrate benefit for our patients or our people. Much, much more invested, much, much more invested at every level, that the bang for the buck is atrocious. Down to this slide. This was a drawing done by Ernie Craig, a very famous member of our faculty. Very famous North Carolinian. Craig Dorn was for, I think, his great-grandfather. Ernie was a UNC undergrad and Rhodes Scholar in Harvard Med, pioneering cardiologist, and for years we'd sit together at Grand Rounds every Thursday and kind of mumble at each other. It's kind of neat. Except he was an excellent cartoonist. And this is, Ernie died at a very ripe old age 2 years ago. This is probably 10 years ago when I realized what was happening and started to mumble at Ernie, and this is his response. By the way, it's no longer a bus, it's a barge going downstream filled with loaded stakeholders, and on the shores are all of us people who are like a little caring. And we will not have it, by saying that if only we took the current system and made it available to everybody and did it more efficiently and did it better, all we will do is have more people on the shores and more stakeholders. It will only happen when we say, what are we trying to accomplish? And are we spending our money to accomplish that? And that's a third rail. That's 17% of the GDP invested in not asking that question. The stimulus bill actually has only $2.1 billion in relative effectiveness trials. You know, there's something called the Cochrane Collaboration that's been around for 15 years that has 10,000 scientists internationally involved in comparative evidence analysis. There are 5,000 documents. They repeat them all the time. It's based out of Oxford in England. It's sponsored by federal governments. Big Pharma tried to underwrite it, and fortunately, they said no. Many of the people are involved as so-called consultants, but this is about as pure as we get. The American College of Physicians Journal Club has been doing this for 6 years. We are loaded with this information. What I've been talking to you is just scratching the surface. There is nothing that anybody could do with what I just told you. And that's why I wrote Worried Sick, and that's why 10 years ago I found it harder and harder to teach medicine at the American Bedside. And that's why 10 years ago I started doing something that I never ever imagined doing, which would be what we're doing tonight. I didn't want to do that. I love teaching medicine. You can't do it in America. You can barely practice it. It takes me 20 seconds to write a prescription and 20 minutes not to. No system can do that. So all I'm doing tonight is getting you to mumble effectiveness, to learn how it is possible to make informed medical decisions based on a tremendous fund of information, and to demand somehow that we start doing that, because otherwise, we're going to head into an implosion. Thank you.